is the Tom Hartman Program.
Zoom audio. And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And we're going to do a special Conversations with Great Minds here today to start right out with Professor Steve Keen. We're going to use Zoom audio. And Professor Keen is the crowdfunded professor of economics. He's the author of a new book, Can We Avoid Another Financial Crash? His website is Prof. Steve Keen, STEVEKEEN.com. You can tweet him at Prof. Steve Keen. And Professor Keen, can you hear me?
Okay, sure. Yeah, I'm talking away, so I hope this is
Professor
coming
Keen?
Okay.
Hello, Professor Keen? Professor Keen?
Can you hear me?
Professor Keen, we're on the air. He can't hear our audio, and I'm locked out.
What I'm not hearing is the audio.
So pot him down. We'll figure this out. We'll get back to this. And in the meantime, Shira, I'm sorry, my computer has completely locked up. And so we're going to restart that, too. Happy Friday. Sure, you need to restart our phone system because everything is dead on this end. So there's a bunch of stories here in the news that I wanted to talk about. And among them is the GOP's Tea Party. We'll get back to Steve Keen in a few minutes, in say 5 or 10 minutes. The GOP's Tea Party win under Obama got twice as much media coverage as the 2018 blue wave. This Eric Bollert writing about this over for Daily Kos. Demonstrators held signs near the new Washington Monument. This was back in September of 2010 when the Tea Party rose up and took over. And it got enormous, absolutely enormous coverage. You know, the Tea Party, the Tea Party was everywhere, and it was everywhere in the media, particularly on television. And the blue wave was not. The Democrats flipped 40 seats in the House. This is a major blue wave pushback. Yet, as Eric Bollert writes, yet the three major television networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, devoted less than half as much time covering the 2018 resistance midterm cycle, which, by the way, was as big a wave, you know, a sweep, as was the so-called Tea Party, takeover. Half as much time. Last year, during Trump's first midterm election cycle, ABC's World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, NBC Nightly News aired 247 minutes on the topic. But during Obama's first midterm election, the same network aircast aired an astonishing 666 minutes. That's 666 versus 247. And this is just nuts, right? The networks weren't just apparently didn't care about the Democrats. I mean, this is astonishing, but it shouldn't be astonishing. There's always been a conservative media bias. It's one of the reasons why the conservatives constantly scream about the liberal media so that they can pretend that there's liberal bias when in fact there isn't. And I mean, you know, this is just like, this is the problem, right? Or a problem that we have with all this. So anyhow, the Tea Party gets everything and this gets nothing, and it's just nuts. It's just nuts. I've got Neo Screener up now. He's not on the board. So, you want to try the Zoom now? Steve Keen, can you hear me? No, he can't. Okay. That's amazing. Okay. Meanwhile, which Democrat does Donald Trump's base fear most in the 2020 presidential election? Good question. It's okay. I can put him up on Telos. Professor Keen, you are there?
Tom.
Yes,
I can.
Yes.
Good to hear you.
Yeah, good. I can talk to you on the phone. I'm going to restart this whole thing. I wanted to commit a good block of time to this, and would appreciate your sticking around with us and talking on the phone. So let me just restart this right now. Professor Steve Keen is with us. It's our conversation with great minds. He is the professor of economics. He's the author of Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? His website, ProfSteveKeen, K-E-E-N.com, and his Twitter handle, ProfSteveKeen, the new Gilded Age. Professor Keen, it's been a while since we've talked, and you know, we've known each other for years, and I have always had such great respect for your insights into economics and how things are, and I appreciate your staying up in London to speak with us. Your newest book, How Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? Let's start at the beginning. Why is it that financial crises happen?
Well, the best answer to that was given by Harman Minsky in a little phrase, which ends up being, summarized as stability is destabilizing. And his basic answer was that capitalism, and I virtually quoted off by heart, I've read it so many times, a capitalist economy is inherently flawed, being prone to booms, crashes, and depressions. The reason is that the financial sector generates signals that encourage an accelerated desire to invest and finance that investment as well. And therefore, you have a tendency to turn what he called doing well into a speculative boom, which he saw as the fundamental weakness of capitalism. And that's what we see time and time again. But, of course, the mainstream of economics tries to model the economy as if it tends towards equilibrium, and as the financial sector has even less of a role than oil has in your car engine. And in fact, it's rather than being the oil or the lubricant, it's actually the fuel.
So that was pretty fast and a little didactic. how would you explain that to a junior high school class?
That's a good question, Tom. I'm sorry for being so technical. Fundamentally, you have two sources of demand in a capitalist economy. One is the turnover of existing money. The other is new money created by credit. When you are an investor, a large part of investment is actually financed by borrowing money from the banks. And that generates additional demand, and the initial demand in the economy, it also, of course, adds to the debt burden you face. Now, when you have, if you had a crisis in the past, and there's always some crisis we remember, you and I might remember back to the 87 crisis. I'm sure the millennials listening now would remember back to the 2008 crisis. And given that background, up in recovery from the crisis, both banks and investors are very conservative about the amount of money they'll put into investment projects. So only very conservatively estimated projects will get funded. And because the economy has recovered from the previous crisis, most of those projects succeed. And what happens is, quite naturally, both investors and bankers think, oh, we were too conservative. If we'd been more levered, we would have made more money. So you get an increase in the degree of leverage people are willing to consider. You have a high level of credit-based demand financing investment. That sets off a boom. As the boom goes on for a while, what happens is capitalists who are borrowing money from bankers to finance their investment have to pay interest on the additional debt they've got. They also start pushing up demand in the economy, so workers finally get to the stage where they can get wage rises as well. The increase in the amount of money going to the workers as wages, to bankers as interest payments and raw materials producers as well, cuts off the profit that capitalists were expecting to get. They get less investment towards the peak of the boom. Because of that, they stop investing, the economy goes into a slump again. And that gives you an explanation for a up and down cycle.
I get it.
Minsky pointed out as well.
Yeah, so basically, it's the, you know, as business starts doing well, or making larger and larger profits, there is a point in time when those profits, they just can't steal all that profit. It basically starts slopping over into the workers and things, and that then creates a dynamic where the workers, the dividends, and the interest of the banks and things causes the businesses to slow down what they're doing. Essentially, am I restating it correctly?
Pretty well. It's quite a simple, when you think about it, it's quite a simple argument talking about the desire to invest in capitalists, which really drives the whole system, the need to borrow money to finance an investment when the level of investment you want to undertake exceeds retained earnings, and then the boom that sets off in the economy, which ultimately means that workers can finally get wage rises, raw material prices go up, so raw material suppliers get a higher amount as well. Capitalists therefore end up with less than they expected to get, pretty well much towards the peak of the boom. And at that point, the desire to invest declines, the economy slows down, and you go into this repeating cycle.
Now, there's an alternative story about this, and that is that when the economy starts to heat up, in the case of the United States, the Federal Reserve Bank, in the case of other countries, you know, similarly the central bank, will say, hey, wait a minute, this is heating up to the point where we're going to start having inflation, what Alan Greenspan used to refer to as wage inflation, which never seems to be applied to CEOs. Mm. And therefore, we have to raise interest rates to slow down just by the same mechanism as you're describing, to slow down the economy, to reduce that inflation. And then that, if it's excessive, if they go too far, that then tips the economy into recession, which is, frankly, what Donald Trump was suggesting a month or so ago. And it looks like Jay, what's his name, you know, the new head of the Fed, took his word on it and said, okay, we'll dial it back. Your thoughts on that? We've got a minute to the break, by the way, and we'll come back and we can continue the conversation.
That's like I'd call that's the icing on the cake. So yes, rising interest rates can slow the system down as well, and I think that will happen before 2020. But the cause that I'm talking about is a more fundamental cause. Even without variations in interest rate, I get a cycle out of this, and I get a cycle which leads to accumulating debt over time, and then finally a crisis like the Great Depression. So the interest rates is a secondary cause, but they can certainly cause trouble, particularly when people who control them don't understand the economy to begin with, and that includes the Federal Reserve.
Shouldn't the Fed see this coming? I mean, when an economy is, when a cycle is heading toward its peak, shouldn't they, like a year or two before that, put on the brakes a little bit to prevent it from hitting that point where the capitalists pull back?
If they should, but if they understood the economy, they would. But they understand their model of the economy, and their model of the economy literally omits banks, debt, and money.
Sure.
And if you leave those three out...
That's amazing. We're talking with Professor Steve Keen, a professor of economics, author of the new book, Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? Prof. Steve Keen is his website and his Twitter handle. We'll be back. It's our Conversations with Great Minds today with Professor Steve Keen. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Can we avoid another financial crisis? How do they happen? What do we do about them? More in just a moment. So, Professor Keen, what is the appropriate response to the tail end of an economic cycle, A, by the Fed, or the equivalent central bank, and B, by average Americans or average working people, and C, by investors?
Well, the response of the Federal Reserve should be, first of all, to rewrite their models. They include banks, debt, and money properly, and therefore they can see these things coming because they're not in their models. That's where they're blindsided all the time. When they do, what they should be looking at is the level of credit-based demand compared to demand from turnover of existing money. And when that gets to be too high, and it was seriously too high for the American economy in between 2005 and 2007, then they should cut back on credit-based demand before it accumulates too much debt, which, of course, is what they didn't do. For the public, if you're facing if you've got fears about an approaching financial crisis, the only thing you can do is get out of debt. Sell any assets you have that are liquid that you don't need. Don't sell your family home if that's the only one you've got, but get out of levered positions, and then that way you can avoid the worst of the downturn. But of course, that sort of behavior by an individual is a bit like an extra person jumping into a lifeboat. The lifeboat might sink. So we have to work at the macroeconomic level rather than trying to get individuals to compensate their way out of the forthcoming crisis.
It's been said, I remember this rather vividly from back in the 1970s during the inflationary explosion. I subscribed to a newsletter by a guy named Howard Ruff. It was called The Rough Times. And he was kind of a right-wing economist who was always talking about how wonderful gold was and stuff like that. But he made a point. He said, you know, when you know that a crash is coming, there are two good positions to be in. One is to have no debt whatsoever and be completely in cash, and so that you can ride out the crash. In fact, the crash becomes a huge buying opportunity for every kind of asset from real estate to stocks. Or number two, to go all in for debt, borrow as much money as you possibly can, convert as much of it as you possibly can into physical assets that you might be able to hold on to, and plan to declare bankruptcy at the peak of it. Now, that's probably a crime to plan that out like that. But is there some truth to that perspective?
I think it's how Donald Trump has made his money by the looks of it.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. If you can actually get to the stage where you pass on your debts, or you make your creditors wear the debts by paying back 1 cent in the dollar in a downturn, which a number of Ponzi financiers have done over time, then that can be successful. But the respectable way to go about it is to be in cash when a crisis comes along, because then the price of assets plunges.
Right.
And this is what people just don't get their heads around, that the assets can fall by a factor of 20, 40, 50% during a crisis while people's liabilities remain constant.
Yeah, had I bought into the stock market in a big way in 2008, I would be a very rich man right now. Not very rich, but, you know, I would have done really well, mm-hmm. let's say, and I think all of us would have. I didn't. A lot of people did. They were smarter than me. That's why I don't give investment advice. But it seems like playing the cycles, though, can be a very, very risky game. So, anyway, we're talking with Professor Steve Keen, professor of economics. His new book, Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? We'll be right back with more of our conversations with great minds of Professor Steve Keen. Prof. Steve Keen, STEVEKEEN.com is his website, and Prof. Steve Keen is also his Twitter handle. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Professor Steve Keen is with us. Our conversations with the great minds. So we've established that these typically 7 to 10 year cycles, regular economic cycles in capitalism, are really a function of how the relationship between the growth of the economy, the simultaneous growth of debt, the desire of capitalists to get a return on their investment, and at the peak of that cycle, their return on investment starts coming down. And so their investment comes down, and that brings about the downturn. Stop me at any point if I get any of this wrong. That the Fed doesn't pay attention to the growing debt and doesn't have banks and things like that in their equations, which is why they always get blindsided by this. And C, that if you think a recession is coming, get out of debt, because being in cash presents you with incredible buying opportunities, like happened in 2008, if nothing else. So there's all that. Where do you think that we are at right now in this economic cycle, and to what extent was the what many of us thought was going to be a recession this year short-circuited by Trump leaning on the Fed?
Well, I've described the global economy as having turned Japanese, if you remember the old song by the Vapors, because Japan was the first country to go into a debt crisis back in 1990. And it did that it had a peak level of private debt of 225% of GDP. And with that level of private debt, first of all, it's a huge burden, a repayment burden on those who owe the debt. And it also means people can't buy assets because it's too expensive to get onto the ground floor to begin with. So you have very low credit demand, and the economy therefore stumbles along, very low levels of demand, very low levels of growth. And whenever the central bank believes that the economy has recovered and starts putting rates up, people start reducing their debt once more. That's been happening in Japan for 25 years, and over that period of time, debt has finally fallen from about 225% of GDP to 160%. And there's a bit of a recovery going on at that level. Now, America's done the same thing, not quite as drastically. It hit 170% of GDP in 2009. It's now down to 150%. That is still a higher level of private debt than America had back during the Great Depression. So what you're going to have is very, very weak demand. Credit demand can easily evaporate. If rates start rising, then people will start to delever and take demand out of the economy. So I don't see another crisis coming for America. I see a crisis for other countries. What I see in America's case is turning Japanese, having occasional recoveries that disappeared far too rapidly, and people wonder why, and you bounce in and out of stagnation potentially for one or two decades.
Wow. Is this the consequence of new Fed policies?
No, it's just a consequence of an ignoring level of private debt for that length of time. If you go back to the beginning of the post-war period, the level of private debt in America was roughly one-third of GDP. Now, because conventional economics says debt plays no role in the macroeconomy, they ignored it. Mm. They kept the data, but they ignored it. Now, in that time, private debt's gone from one-third of GDP to 170%, you know, increasing by a factor of five. If you ignore something that matters and it gets to be five times as big, you've got a problem. And that's the situation America has got itself into, specifically because the economic profession does not understand the role of credit or debt in the macroeconomy.
Remarkable. And if you want to learn all about it, you can read Professor Steve Keen's numerous books. His most recent, Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? His website, Prof, P-R-O-F, as in Professor Steve, S-T-E-V-E, Keen, K-E-E-N.com. It's also his Twitter handle. Professor Keen, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome, Tom.
It's been great talking with you. I really appreciate it. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
It's Anything Goes Friday on top of that, so we'll pick up your phone calls after the break. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. I've got a bunch of stories here that I'm going to be sharing with you as we go through the day, but we will get to those. Steve in Gilderland, New York. Am I saying that right, Steve?
You are, Tom, and good afternoon. And I just wanted to suggest that you might want to start running a message warning your listeners that prolonged exposure to the Tom Hartman Show and reading your books might lead to increased activism. Joining the Democratic Committee and potentially running for office like I am right now.
Oh, my. Tell us about it, Steve. That's great.
I've been listening to your show for about 13 years. And back in around 2008 time, you started talking about the Concord Project.
Yeah.
And joining the committees.
Yep, precinct committee chairs.
Yep. And so I've been on the local Democratic Committee for about 10 years. And recently, our progressive county legislator won our local town. He's now our town judge, leaving the office open. And so I decided to step forward and run for New York Albany County legislator.
Wow. The New York's equivalent of the House of Representatives. What's it called? The Assembly?
Well, this is at the county level.
Oh, at the county level. Oh, great.
County level.
Great.
Yep. That's... So it's my first step, my first rodeo, basically.
Yeah, and that's how you do it. Well, that's wonderful, Steve. Yeah. If our listeners wanted to support you, I don't know if you want national support, but if they wanted to support you, feel free to plug a website.
Well, my website is electsteve, S-T-E-V-E, 2019.org.
Okay, electsteve2019.org. Steve, thank you for the thanks for the acknowledgement, but mostly thank you for, you know, signing up to become a precinct committee person, joining your local Democratic Party, and now running for office. I am so impressed. Well, congratulations.
And listening to your show has really been, you know, and reading your books have really taught me a lot and helped me. You know, the one biggest thing is learning how to communicate and debate with conservatives and other people who don't necessarily share my same views.
Great.
Well, I really appreciate that.
So my efforts that leave me sometimes, you know, banging my head against the wall after I get off the air are apparently, you know, efforts
but
that
you
are
teach us well placed. How to have those conversations, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Steve.
And I think it will serve me well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good luck. Keep us up to date and let us know how it's going. Thank you, Steve. Scott in Mission, Kansas. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. So I wanted to talk about the Southern strategy. And one of the things I've seen you talk about a lot is how it was effective in basically turning the GOP into what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I've sort of noticed is it was also effective in, like, desensitizing white Americans who live in rather homogenous areas to issues regarding race and sort of the plight of African Americans. Like, I know you mentioned that experiment with the white mice and the black mice.
Right.
And one thing I've noticed just living here in Kansas is, especially in the area I live in, I went to a predominantly white high school. And so I, up until like my junior and senior years of high school, I was unaware of like the issues regarding race with police brutality, and then also some racial issues here in my own state. I don't know if you're familiar with J.C. Nichols.
Boy, that name sounds familiar, but refresh my memory.
He created the truce dividing line in, I think it's Kansas City, Missouri, where it was to keep the white people in higher and upper mid-income housing and to keep, like, African-Americans and people of color in low-income housing.
Hmm.
And just a couple years ago, a friend of mine's dad wrote in the Kansas City Star that we need to rename the J.C. Nichols Fountain because of the racial histories behind it.
Wow.
And it was basically like he was comparing it to how southern states were taking down Confederate memorials. And so I thought it was interesting because, you know, me, I wasn't unaware of these issues until recently. And now that I'm aware, I see that there is a lot more racism that the United States needs to overcome than I did previously. I think part of that is an effect of the Southern Strategy,
yeah,
where people like me don't realize this until recently, and now when they realize it, they start to become more aware and want to change something about that.
Let me see, Scott, if I can feed back to you what I think I'm hearing you say, and that is that when Nixon rolled out the Southern Strategy in 68, to reach out to white racists in the South who had been voting Democratic for years and years and years, now that the Democratic Party had abandoned them with the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, that when Nixon did that, the principal way that he reached out to those white racists in the South was by talking about crime and welfare. And he very rarely used words that were racially charged or, you know, that explicitly mentioned race. But race was the clear and obvious subtext to pretty much everything he was saying, and pretty much everything every Republican politician from that day to this has been saying. And as a consequence of that, a lot of white people who live in a white bubble heard that language and internalized that message without even realizing that it could have been written by the Klan. Is that a reasonable recharacterization of what you just said?
Yeah, I think it's fair.
Yeah. Because you know, I think that that's absolutely true. I know that I was contaminated by that back in the day. I think that, you know, probably the vast majority, if not all, white people in the United States were in one way or another. You know, in thinking about issues about, you know, welfare and schools and all these other things. Yeah, I get it, Steve. I absolutely get it. That's a good one. Steve, thank you for the observation. It's brilliant. Matt in Napa, California, listening on 9:10 a.m. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. Just want to talk a little bit about the testimony yesterday, Michael Cohen, especially in regard to the question when he apparently witnessed Trump speaking with Roger Stone about receiving the WikiLeaks email.
Right.
Leaks, and the congressman that was talking to him said that he felt that Trump should have contacted the FBI at that point. And so I guess my question is whether it made a difference. I mean, clearly Trump, in theory at least, would not have known whether it was an internal leak from the Democratic National Committee or whether it was the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was the former, is there any legal responsibility for Trump to have done that implication?
I don't know. I believe that if he thought that at any level, that a foreign government was trying to influence the U.S. election or was trying to help him in a way that would influence an election, that he had an obligation to report that to the FBI. I believe that to be the case, particularly as a candidate for federal office. But I'm not sure, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know if that's the law. There's, you know, Karen Tumulty wrote a Washington Post column a day or two ago that raises some really interesting questions around this. And, you know, one of them is, what if the interference by the Internet Research Bureau, this Russian troll farm, you know, principally that, let's, you know, say principally that, well, and the hacking of the Democratic Party emails and the release of them via WikiLeaks, what if those things were done by Russia not to make Trump president, but to weaken President Hillary Clinton, which everybody expected was going to be the case, because Clinton has been so hard on Russia over the years and was one of the real cheerleaders for basically, you know, kicking the Russians out of Ukraine and going after Russians with sanctions and things after Crimea. So what if they were really just trying to weaken her as an incoming president, kind of establish a base of eroding her credibility, essentially? At the same time that, you know, Trump was running for president, and he didn't expect to win either. He was just trying to raise his brand. You know, we now know that pretty much for a fact. That in fact, that's one of the things that Michael Cohen said. He had no intention of becoming president. He just wanted to raise the value of his brand so he could make more money. And he wanted to build this Trump Tower in Moscow and was negotiating it right up to the election. And so these were like simultaneous events. So Trump is going easy on Russia. Russia is basically kicking Hillary, you know, in the gut as much as they can, because they don't like her and her policies, and that they're not actually talking to each other. They're not actually colluding to make Donald Trump president. Trump is not reaching out to them and saying, help make me president, because he doesn't really actually want to be president. And they're not reaching out to Trump and saying, we'll make you president. And that, in fact, that meeting in Trump Tower, you know, with Don Jr., was really more about, we're just trying to get the sanctions lifted because our oligarchs are screaming. And, you know, can you help in some way, even if you're not president? And it's a really interesting question. I mean, if that's the scenario, and there actually wasn't, quote, collusion or even conspiracy, it just kind of danced around the edges of it. How, you know, what do we do with that? And now that we know that, you know, or we have a fairly high level of certainty. I mean, last night Rachel Maddow was talking about how, you know, Trump took this mansion that he bought in New York State for $7 million that is valued by the county at $19 million now. It was bought back in the 90s for tax purposes, and claimed that it was worth over $250 million in documents that he gave the Deutsche Bank when he tried to get a billion-dollar loan to buy the Buffalo Bills. That's bank fraud. So we've got a guy who we know is a criminal, or it sure looks like he's a criminal, has engaged in bank fraud in the past. These are the crimes that Paul Manafort's going to jail for. He engaged in campaign finance fraud, paying off McDougal and Stormy Daniels. And that's, you know, that's a felony. And that arguably is one of the reasons why he's president, because those stories didn't come out. So he not only engaged in campaign finance fraud, but he did so in a way that made him president. Isn't that enough to impeach him? Isn't that enough to remove him from office? Isn't that enough to actually get past the old, Nixon and Reagan Justice Departments, or Nixon and Bush, I guess it was, Justice Departments saying, no, you can't indict a sitting president, at the time when, in both cases, you had sitting presidents who had clearly committed crimes? Is that enough to go after him? What do you think about that, Matt?
Well, yeah, maybe so, but my question was really about the legitimacy of whether the Russians actually committed the hack or not, which I'm not convinced about. The Veterans for Professional Sanity and William Benny studies, I think there's a lot in the news that's not being covered in that regard.
Mm. So you're suggesting that it's possible that the WikiLeaks release didn't even come out of the Russians?
Sure.
Didn't come out of Russia? I thought that all of the intelligence agencies were unanimous on this, in part because of all the Russian metadata that they found in some of the files.
Actually, Clapper's come out and said that that's not the case, that he handpicked just a few members from each of those committees, and there was no sign-off from all 17 agencies.
Well, and Julian Assange is saying that, he doesn't believe it came from the Russians, but I think the way that you submit to WikiLeaks is largely anonymous. It's interesting. I am hopeful that all this stuff ultimately comes out in the wash. I don't know where it's going. I don't know what it means, other than that it's like really stinky stuff, and that it looks like more to come in this election. Matt, thanks for listening to AM 910. Thanks for the call. We'll be back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday. It's 47 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls in just a moment. And welcome back. Dina in Laconer, Washington. Hey, Dina, what's on your mind today?
going to go back to health insurance, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I'm an RN, and I work for an insurance company, and I've always had pretty decent benefits, you know, PPO with a copay and, you know, 80% hospitalization, that sort of thing. When we had open enrollment in November, my benefits changed, and I have the highest plan that you can get. My benefits went up about $20 a month. And I essentially get, my kids and I get one preventative visit a year each, and everything else is subject to the $5,000 deductible.
Whoa.
Everything. Medication, everything. I mean, I just can't believe it. It's like, it's essentially a catastrophic plan.
Yeah, these banksters are robbing us blind, these banksters who call themselves health insurance companies. And, and the drug companies, too. And you know, Ron Wyden went off on them a couple of days ago, and we talked about it in this program. But I saw virtually no coverage of that anywhere on network television, because network television, of course, is heavily subsidized by the drug companies. But,
well,
yeah.
And that's another point. And I'm curious to know if other people had this experience. I don't think it's my company, really. But the other thing is, now that I have to pay for my, you know, the drugs, they keep sending me these requests to go to buy every 3 months and save money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a savings of about $12 a month,
right,
off of $90. And I'm so mad at them. I thought, no, I'm not doing that, because they own Express Scripts. And then I go and I look, you know, it's the thing where the insurance company owns.
Yeah, so
your
insurance company must be, was it Aetna bought Express Scripts? Is that recall?
I have Anthem Blue Cross.
Anthem, that's right. Anthem bought Express Scripts.
And so I go and look on the Alex site, and Express Scripts, there you go. All about Alex.
Yeah.
I'm just furious.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
all of it.
Yeah, we but really
yeah,
need.
That's what's going on.
We really need Medicare for all, Dina, and your story is an example of that. And it's, you know, for a long time it was that we were being nickeled and dimed to death. And then it seems like maybe, I don't know, early in the Bush administration, it seemed like they really just started, you know, they just dropped the hammer. They just started nailing people, you know, really aggressively, kicking people off coverage and raising these deductibles and just trying to see, you know, what's the point at which the American public screams? And I think that scream that we heard, it was expressed as Obamacare, you know, as that program going through. And then they funded, you know, the whole Tea Party thing to push back on it. I mean, it's an incredibly corrupt system. And we have...
It's immoral and it's criminal, in my opinion.
I absolutely agree with you, Dina. We have the most corrupt political system of any fully developed democracy in the world. And the reason why is because the Supreme Court has said that corporations are persons and that they have the First Amendment free speech right, and that includes the right to own a politician, to give money to politicians, and to pour as much money as they want into political campaigns like ballot initiatives. And the result of that is just absolutely screaming insane corruption. And then, you know, people like you and me and all the rest of us get screwed by them. It's terrible. Dina, thank you for the call. I really appreciate it. It's 51 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour here, breaking news. The United States, you know, Trump is coming back. He apparently Kim got what he wanted. He got, you know, elevated onto the world stage as a major leader, as somebody equal to the United States. He is the leader of a nation. He is equal to the president of the United States, something no other president ever would have done or ever did. With the Kim family in the 80, 90 years, however long it's been that they've been, you know, running the North Korea as an iron-fisted dictatorship. Otto Warmbier's family has come out and said basically that they're outraged. In fact, here's the exact quote. "We have been respectful during the summit process. Now we must speak out. Kim and his evil regime are responsible for the death of our son, Otto. Kim and his evil regime are responsible for unimaginable cruelty and inhumanity. No excuses or lavish praise can change that." Going right after the president. And now it appears that Trump has come back and ordered the Pentagon to stop joint defense exercises with South Korea. So that, you know, poor Kim won't feel nervous or intimidated. This is bizarre. Mike in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening to 1350 AM. Hey, Mike, what's up? Mike? In Albuquerque?
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Yeah, I would like to talk about a new take sort of on political correctness. I'd like to advocate for political correctness in language. It seems to me what's happening is a complete collapse of, language in the Anglosphere as far as democracy or economy or anything.
Mike, isn't political correctness simply a euphemism for being polite, for common courtesy?
No, I'm taking a different like to your screener. I gave the example of we use the word creating jobs, but what we fail to see when we say something like creating jobs actually destroys livelihoods.
What does that mean?
Well, with that,
how?
If a company comes in and creates a bunch of jobs, these jobs can come and go, if this big company comes into a town and,
sure,
whether it's Home Depot or whatever.
Right.
But it's destroyed a whole bunch of livelihoods.
Oh, of the small businesses that were there before. The average Walmart kills over 100 companies when they move into a town. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, yeah. Another thing that we have in our language is, the word economy. Mm-hmm. And it's regarded as some sort of science. Economy is not science. It's a religion. It's socialist, it's capitalist, it's communist, or these are religions in a sense. They're agreements that we, choose to take on as far as, like, this is how we're going to divvy up. The only science is ecology. There is no economy without an ecology.
Yeah.
And this is sort of like, the inference, that's sort of the inference with the Green New Deal, which, I support. Because it sort of says, like, well, you can't have an economy if you don't have an ecology. Ecology is science.
Yeah. No, I get it. And that's an excellent point, Mike. And with the Green New Deal, what AOC is doing basically is saying, the New Deal worked. It put millions of Americans back to work and built America, turned America into the world's powerhouse. We can do it again, only in this time, instead of building, highways and dams, we'll be building, solar and wind infrastructure. I get it. That's a good one. Dee in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Dee, anything goes Friday. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for being here. I just want to say Trump is like an iceberg. America is like the Titanic, and the Republicans are complaining about the dessert. I don't know if the world will stop America, because our hate is so blind that we're looking past all of Trump's failings, not just Trump, but his whole gamut, the nepotism and everything, because of hate. And I have a friend who, when he became American, he was told to stay away from people of color, basically black people. And so that's like the danger of a single story. So before you even meet a person to discover who they are, you've already created this image. And so it just perpetuates throughout that we just look past all of this. And I want to know, why aren't the Republicans, the Tea Party, whatever, the Republicans protecting America?
Because they have no interest in protecting us. They only want to exploit us. They want to extract as much cash as possible from the American working class, period, full stop.
It's going to affect the world, and the world will... You know how much we depend on the world? There's nothing we use every day that doesn't come from around the world. And if we put walls around this country,
Yeah, no, I'm with you, Dee. And as much as Trump talks about protectionism, we just had the second... We just had the largest trade deficit in, I don't know, I think maybe in history. It was almost $1 trillion. It's over $900 billion. And the previous year was just pretty much just as bad. Trump is actually, in terms of trade deficits, jobs coming home, making things worse. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.